It's midday and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Johnny Flynn is a polymath as comfortable as an actor on stage and screen as he is writing and performing songs. You've perhaps seen him as Mr. Knightley in the film Emma or as Ian Fleming in Operation Mincemeat. In his latest film, One Life, he stars alongside Anthony Hopkins as the young Nicholas Winton, who helped Jewish children flee from the Nazis in what became known as the Kindertransport. He's currently starring as Richard Burton in the play The Motive and the Cue, the story of how Burton and Sir John Gielgud clashed as they staged Hamlet on Broadway in 1964. Johnny's also released four albums with his band, Johnny Flynn and the Sussex Wit. He composed the theme song for the acclaimed television series Detectorists, and more recently, he's collaborated with the nature writer Robert McFarlane on two folk albums, Lost in the Cedarwood and The Moon Also Rises. Well, we're going to hear music, Johnny, by Paul Robeson, Sondheim, Bizet. First, though, choral music by Fauré.
Yeah. It was hard to choose any of these songs, really, because there were so many that came to mind, but I wanted to choose something that linked me to my childhood. I was a querister, not a chorister, a querister, which is the boy treble part that sings at the Winchester College Chapel. And it was, in lots of ways, quite a sad time for me because I was boarding away from home, but there were kind of, in my memory, there's glimpses of light, and this piece was one of them. I suppose there's a holiness to it, there's a simplicity to it, and I believe Fauré was very young when he wrote it, and something of that naivety is there, but also it's so musically perfect, and from such a young mind, that touched me, realising that. I just love it. I particularly love the tenor line, and when my voice broke, I loved being able to sing that. I love it.
It has a wonderfully sort of calming, cloistered feel to it,
yeah,
doesn't it?
It's the sound of a prayer. It kind of surges up. It's this kind of slow question, and it's particularly suited to evensong, I think. It's that kind of coming to a place of peace before going to bed or, you know, or death or whatever. You know, it's beautiful.
Cantique de Jean Racine by Gabriel Fauré, performed by the choir of St John's College, Cambridge, with the organist Stephen Clebury then, conducted by George Guest. You were born, Johnny Flynn, in South Africa, but you moved to the UK when you were two. Are you aware of that background?
Yeah, we have this connection through family who's still there. And my parents met there. My dad was an actor and he was on tour with a play and met my mum, and they stayed there. And then in the mid-80s, amidst all the stuff going on there, I think they thought, this is it, we should get out.
How did you find boarding school, the Pilgrim School in Winchester in Hampshire? I mean, was it tricky leaving your parents? Some people find that very hard, other people find it exhilarating.
Yeah, I found it really hard. I've got a 7-year-old daughter now, and I think she's quite like me. I think if I packed her off to school and said, this is what's happening, she'd be sort of wide-eyed and be a bit like, oh, okay, which is what I was like. And we didn't have much money. I had a violin teacher who said he might be good enough to get a scholarship. And I think my mum very sweetly thought, you know, this is a fantastic opportunity. But being a choral scholar meant staying in till Sunday morning, coming back Sunday evening for evensong. So you didn't even sleep in your own bed at home till the holidays. And I've learned to be less cruel about the school in particular, because I think when I was in my 20s, I was quite angry about it. I thought, well, how could you do that to kids, you know? It's a serious regimented training for the choristers and the quiristers, and we were singing every day for hours.
Well, I was going to say, did you not find, finally, that actually it was a rather wonderful training for what you now are?
Well, yeah, I'm incredibly grateful that I can read music and I can speak to musicians and I score things. You know, I can write out music on a stave and hand it to somebody who I've never met before and they can...
It's magic, isn't
it? It's incredible.
Did you play another instrument as well as the violin?
I played violin and trumpet. I had a go at piano and I couldn't split my head in two to do two hands on the piano. I've since, like, learned how to play some honky-tonky piano. And then I taught myself guitar as an act of rebellion when I turned 12 or 13.
It's much better, isn't it, to discover this music for yourself in due course rather than have it sort of forced
on
you.
Totally, yeah. My son plays the cello at the moment and he's playing these really lovely romantic pieces. It's not stuff that I would put on, you know, I'd listen to Bach or whatever, but it's so great because he's learning how to play with heart, and I think you need to ride that wave with kids. And
well,
I
this next music is cello music, isn't it?
I think
it was suggested to you by a fellow band member.
Yeah, so I had a rocky relationship with Bach because he was one of these composers that I felt was sort of foisted on me as a teenager. I had a strict violin teacher who had me playing partitas all the time. And I just sod this. And I went off and played trad fiddle music. And so Bach was the enemy. But in my early 20s, I met a dear friend, well, reconnected with a dear friend who had actually grown up within the same village, Joe Zeitlin, who's a fantastic cellist. And he started playing in my band. And we've toured together for 20 years or something now. Bach is his religion. And Bach is everything you need to know about music in a way. And it's where a divine geometry and music combine, and you can get it badly, badly wrong. So I wanted to find one of the cello suites, which I love so much, that is a good recording, and Yo-Yo Ma's one of the best. Thank you. I love how something without words can have so much sort of story in it. I went on a pilgrimage to Bach's grave a few years ago in Leipzig because I was filming near there, and it was an amazing thing to stand near his bones in the church where he was the choral master.
It's very odd how sometimes visiting those sort of graves of people who are heroes, who mean a lot to you, does have a profound effect, really, even though they're no longer there.
Yeah.
We heard the prelude from Bach's Unaccompanied Cello Suite No. 4 in E-flat major, performed wonderfully by Yo-Yo Ma. Johnny Flynn, you come from really quite a wide acting family, don't you? Apart from your parents, Eric Flynn and Caroline Forbes, there are other members of the family who are actors.
Yes, yeah, so two brothers, Jerome and Daniel Flynn, who are actors. So my dad married twice, and we've got three siblings from his first marriage, Jerome, Dan and Kerry. And his first wife, Fern, was an actress, and her father was an actor. So on their side of the family, there's even more. And my brother Daniel's married to an actress, and her parents are actors.
And your younger sister, Lily, is an actress.
She's an actress. And we get together at Christmas, and we try not to talk about acting, because it gets really boring. I think in terms of Dad and his kids, it was something magical in the atmosphere that he created in terms of our sense of what he did. And for all of us, the memory of going backstage and the privilege of being this side of the curtain and seeing how the illusion was created somehow was more of an illusion, was more of an enticing situation. And we all love storytelling, I suppose.
You didn't just simply step on to the stage as part of a dynasty, as it were. You went to the Webber Douglas Academy of Dramatic Art to study acting. Yeah. And one of your first roles was in an all-male Shakespeare troupe?
Yeah, directed by Ed Hall, called Propeller. And it was fantastic. We travelled around the world for about a year with two plays, with Tammy the Shrew and Twelfth Night. Twelfth Night, in which I had to get naked as Sebastian, which was a shock in the rehearsal room when Ed told me that that's what he wanted.
And you worked a lot with Mark Rylance then?
Yeah, doing Jerusalem. And then he invited me to be part of another all-male company and to play Viola, this time with him as Olivia at the Globe and then in the West End. And we did that in Richard III, in which I played Lady Anne. So spent a lot of time with him. He's a dear friend.
Your dad didn't particularly want you to become an actor, did he?
Definitely not, no. He begged me not to. So he died when I was 18, just before I went to drama school. I think I got my place at Webber Douglas about a week before he died. And I've got this letter from him saying, you know, if you're serious about acting, then you won't go to that place. And he meant you should go to RADA. But I think he was a bit out of touch. And he'd been to RADA in the 50s. And I think he just was so fearful for me, as he would have been for all of his kids, that it would have been hard. And at that point there was no way of reassuring him that it wasn't, you know, that I was going to be okay. But it has been okay, touch wood, so far.
He would have been very pleased, proud of what you've
done. Think so, yeah. I hope so.
Well, it'd be nice to actually hear him, and we can now, because the next music you've chosen features him singing with Sean Phillips, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. I wanted to choose something with him. And one of my earliest memories was this production, which started in Chichester, and I think I must have been about 5 or 6, and we spent the summer in Chichester, and then it came into London, and obviously this is a hugely famous song, but it's lovely that I've got a recording of him singing it.
Send in the Clowns by Sondheim from A Little Night Music.
Isn't it rich? Are we a pair? You hear at last on the ground, you in midair. Was that a
fault, I fear?
Me as a merry-go-round,
me as King Lear.
Mm-hmm.
applause for the clowns.
They're finally
Send in the Clowns from Stephen Sondheim's A Little Night Music with Sian Phillips and Eric Flynn, the father of my guest today, Johnny Flynn. Must be rather moving to hear that, especially since he died when, as you explained, you were at a very vulnerable stage in your life about to go to drama school.
Yeah, it's touching, and I love that I have these recordings of him.
A good voice.
Yeah, fantastic voice, known for his voice. It's funny because at the point that he died, I'd moved home to kind of be near him and help care for him. And then I went to drama school in London, moved to London for the first time the following September, and my head of acting and my voice teacher had been in his class at RADA. I found that really comforting because I think moving into a life without him and moving into the profession that he'd been, you know, the guiding light towards for me, and then to have that continuity and meeting people that knew him. And that's happened to me all my adult life as a professional actor. And at the moment I'm working with Sam Mendes in this play, and Sam was the assistant director on that production of A Little Night Music as his first job, I think. And so he has these memories of my dad as an adult that I don't have, and he's telling this stuff to me doing our play, The Mouse in the Cube, which is about fathers and sons. And there's this kind of amazing synchronicity to it all.
You've always made music alongside your acting, and particularly exploring English and American folk traditions. What is it that you love about that? And is there something about the connection with the land which also echoes with your work with Robert McFarlane?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think all the classical composers, Bach included, are constantly referencing folk music and traditional music. In the cello suites, there's one of them that mimics a hurdy-gurdy harmony. And, you know, the high culture is not that separate from the stuff that's closer to the ground. And I love this quote by Mahler, "Tradition is tending the flame, not worshipping the ashes."
That's very good.
So I guess, even though I've had this classical music training, my love of folk music, my love of music that feels like it could be sung in any room by anyone with passion and with feeling and that kind of pure-heartedness is always there.
You've described your songwriting very nicely, I think, as a way of processing the world, and without doing that, I feel kind of lost.
Yeah. I've never been able to keep a diary. I tried when I was about 9 years old and I started lying. I've had therapy and I find it quite hard sort of articulating what's happening to me, but somehow writing music, playing music, centres me and puts me in touch with where I really am right now. And there's an openness that music requires to the universe. And you mentioned Rob McFarlane and our connection. He's not a musician, but loves music and understands music. But we write a lot by either corresponding, but we also go on long walks. And it's just been a very natural connection, and we share the same principles. And he's such a bringer together of people and ideas, and he's a safe harbour for good thought. And we've got so many things now cooking. I don't know how I've gotten involved with all this stuff, but he's a
it's
maker.
Very interesting
and a doer
to me that you've mentioned both Mark Rylance and Robert McFarlane as, in a way, safe harbours. Clearly you feel that need for them, possibly because of the early loss of your father.
Quite possibly, yeah. I think I have always looked to, I mean, Rob would cuff me for saying an older person. He's not that much older than me, but, you know, he's a teacher, and he's certainly a teacher for me, as well as a friend. Yeah, I've often looked for maybe older male figures in the absence of a father, men and women. But, yeah, for me, friendship is just the most important thing in the world. The older I get, the more importance I place on that, because it's just hard to go through this crazy world alone, you know. And making music with people, my band, who have been dear friends, and sharing that experience is so much more profound than going through it on your own.
Well, this would be a nice point at which to have some folk music.
Yeah.
What have you chosen?
The Good Old Way. It's a kind of mid-18th century evangelical hymn embraced by folk singers. It's part of that kind of Wesleyan tradition, good godly singing. And I chose this because I love the Watersons and the rough-hewn passion of their voices together. But also this song we've started singing with a group of friends in midwinter every year as part of a wassailing tradition that we've set up in our community. We go and libate the community orchard in the park and then we go around to people's houses and we sing at them whether they like it or not. And we do proper wassailing songs, but as we're marching up the street, we sing this song. I love it. The pure-hearted, we're coming, we're marching.
Lift up your heart, Emmanuel's friends, and taste the pleasure Jesus sends. Let nothing cause you to delay, but hasten in the good old way, for I have a sweet hope and glory in this day. I have a sweet hope of glory in this song, for I know I have, and I feel I have, a sweet hope of glory in my soul. Our conflicts, dear Lord, great they may, shall not prevent our victory. If we but strive and watch and pray like soldiers in the good old way, for I have a sweet hope and glory in this song. I have a sweet hope of glory in this song, for I know I am, and I feel I have a sweet hope of glory in my soul. Satan may his powers employ, our happiness for to destroy, yet never fear, we'll gain the day by marching in the good old way. For I have a sweet hope and glory in this song. I have a sweet hope and glory in this song. For I know I have, and I feel I have, a sweet hope of glory in my soul. Ye valiant souls for heaven contend, remember glory is at the end. Our God will wipe our tears away when we have run on the good old way. For I have a sweet hope and glory in this song. I have a sweet hope of glory in this song. For I know I have, and I feel I have, a sweet hope of glory in my soul. And far beyond this mortal shore we'll meet with those who have gone before, and shout to think we'll gain the day by marching in the good old way. For I have a sweet hope and glory in the song. I have a sweet hope and glory in the song. For I know I have, and I feel I have, a sweet hope of glory in my soul.
The Good Old Way by the Watersons, from the album For Pence and Spicy Ale. There's something about the rawness that makes it, isn't it? I mean, if it was sung by a beautifully cultivated church choir with choristers, it wouldn't really have quite the same feel, would it?
No, it'd be dead boring, I think. It's rough and passionate, but it's so musical. I just love that. And for me, discovering stuff like that after having been through this rigid choral training was really liberating. And I had to do a lot of unconditioning.
It's quite difficult to do that, isn't it? If you've been trained to sing properly.
Yeah, well, some of the things can stay there, you know, your breath support and things like that. There's things that you can use from the training, but I think letting your heart lead as opposed to your head is how I'd describe it. And letting your personality, each of those voices on their own are going to be completely unique. But I think that's more what I'm interested in now for my own singing.
Curiously, in the film Emma, in which you played Mr. Knightley, it was music actually that was the turning point, wasn't it? Because it's when Emma hears you sing that she truly falls for you.
Yeah, Autumn de Wilde had a lot of these ideas. She's grown up photographing musicians and grown up around music. And she came to me quite early on in the project saying, what is the earthy English music that I can use for the film? She could talk about kind of Baptist singing and shape note singing from America, but she wanted the British English version of that. And I introduced her to the Watersons. So there's recordings of the Watersons singing in the film. But then, in that scene where I'm singing and playing violin, I suppose that's a moment where Emma realises. And then I got to write the song at the end of the film from Knightley's perspective about Emma. You haven't heard his voice yet. You've been inside her head for the whole story. And so you hear his appraisal of her and this love song, kind of tongue-in-cheek love song from him at the end.
We've discovered, Johnny, that you do have a real love of the human voice. We've had the Watersons. And the next piece is Paul Robeson.
Who I discovered through my dad, who gave me a tape when I was about 9 or 10 of Paul Robeson singing at the Peace Arch concerts, and just said, you know, this is the thing. I've been in love with his voice all my life. There's a certain resonance to his voice, a certain power and spirit.
Having heard your father sing, I can see why he would really like this.
Yeah, well, he was his big hero, not just as a singer, but as a man, because he came to Wales and stood alongside striking miners. And he was, I think, the first black actor to come over and play Othello, and then was kicked out of America for being labelled as a communist, and lived in Europe in exile for years, and was a complicated man in his private life. But he stood up for things, and he used his voice. Songs that connect people in moments of crisis, an early civil rights campaigner, and just a beautiful human being.
Every time I feel the spirit moving in my heart, I pray. Every time I feel the spirit moving in my heart, I pray. From the mountain my Lord spoke, out his mouth came fire and smoke. In the valley on my knees, ask my Lord, have mercy please. Every time I feel a spirit moving in my heart, I pray. Every time I feel the spirit moving in my heart, I pray. Jordan River, chill cold, chills the body but not the soul. All around me looks so shine, ask my Lord if all was mine. Every time I feel the spirit moving in my heart, I pray. Every time I feel the spirit moving in my heart, I will pray.
My dad told me of a time he actually met Paul Robeson. Late in Robeson's life, he was in hospital in London. My dad was doing a cabaret review, singing songs with a group of people, and they were doing a tour of hospitals around Christmas to try and cheer the patients up. And a lady in the ward came up to him after the concert, said, my husband was too ill, he's in a private room upstairs, would you mind, you're singing his favourite songs, won't you come and sing to him? And he went upstairs, and it was Paul Robeson. And so he was there singing, you know, Old Man River and these songs that Robeson had made famous to his hero. So I loved that personal connection as well. And Dad was a fantastic storyteller, and I think this one was true, but I'll hold on to it anyway.
What a wonderful story. Every Time I Feel the Spirit by Paul Robeson, with Alan Booth playing the piano. Your most recent film, Johnny Flynn, is called One Life, And it's about an extraordinary man, Nicholas Winton.
Yeah, as a young man, he was a stockbroker, and he was invited by a school friend to go out and see the situation in Prague, where Jewish refugees had flooded the city and they were in these awful conditions in camps. It was desperate and winter was coming, and he was horrified, and he quickly found a group of people who were trying to help. And the least he thought he could do was to try and get the children out. So he set up a children's refugee department and worked out through just sheer canniness and bloody-mindedness how to get the Nazis to stamp the visas.
The sort of Schindler story.
Yeah, he's often called the British Schindler. And he wasn't yet 30, I think. And he rescued 669 children, I think, on trains through Europe that arrived in Liverpool Street. And then he and his mother found families and homes for these children. And then the last train, with several hundred children on it, was due to leave the day that Germany invaded Poland, and it never left. And he never knew what happened to the kids. And the presumption is that they were all sent to death camps. And he was a very humble man, spent the rest of his life doing charitable work, but never told anyone what he'd done.
His achievements only came to light quite shortly before he died, I think.
Yeah, so right at the end of his life, his scrapbook was discovered. And there's this amazing clip, you can see it on YouTube or wherever, and he was kind of almost tricked into going on to That's Life with Esther Ranson. He sat in the audience and they put the real children around him that he'd rescued. And it's terribly moving. And in the film, that point in his life, he's played by Anthony Hopkins, and they recreated that scene and they used the real children of the children, who'd be about the right age now. And, of course, everybody was in bits on the day filming. So and particularly with what's going on now, we made the film last year before everything that's happened recently with Israel and Palestine. But, you know, we were thinking about Syria and Ukraine and all these dire situations where, despite any political stuff going on, just innocent people, children in particular, are just being put through awful circumstances. And so the film feels important on that level.
Michael Hurley next.
Yeah. So I wanted something from this period of resurgence of folk music in America in the early 60s. And I fell in love with Bob Dylan, but early Bob Dylan, from this period. When I was about 13, 14, I discovered the album The Freewheeling Bob Dylan, and his voice and his connection to something ancient through Woody Guthrie and Ledbetter and all those people spoke to me. But then I discovered something outside the box that Michael Hurley was a part of. I love him, and he's still alive. He's in his 80s, and he's still making records, and they're all brilliant and weird and therefore so personal to him. He's not trying to fit in any way. He's just a pure expression of himself. So this is the tea song.
Turn on the tea and let it brew. Break out the cups and the honey too. I don't care that she's left me. So long as the cupboard's full of tea. Oh, my nerves are shaking and my heart is breaking. Whoa. That's just because of all the tea I take.
The Tea Song by Michael Hurley, recorded in 1964. You've been in a television series on Sky called The Lovers, another very different role, where you're Seamus, a political television broadcaster.
Yeah, that was a joy to be a part of, written by David Ireland, who's one of my favourite playwrights. And I just found it very unusual writing in a popular medium of a rom-com bridging across personal political divides and class, and really, really, really funny and dark. And I love working with Roisin Gallagher, the amazing actress.
You have a relationship with her. She's a somewhat foul-mouthed supermarket worker, isn't she? And you have the dilemma of the fact that you're already in a relationship.
Yeah. So it comes up against that theme of faithfulness and adultery and deals with it in a very compassionate way. It's messy and it's real, and sometimes these are the situations we find ourselves in, I suppose.
The love triangle is duplicated to a certain extent in the next piece.
Yeah, the story is hugely romantic. And
the pearlfish is.
The pearlfish is dramatic. But at the heart of it is this duet between the two friends. And I love lots of things about it, but it's a passionate love song between two male friends. It's their commitment to each other.
And the threat that their love for the same person presents.
Yeah, and the promise that they're making to each other that they won't break that vow, which, of course, one of them does. But the reason why I chose this is because when I was a querister, we were chosen to be the kind of top part in a professional touring production of The Pearlfishers. And I remember standing in the wings each night and weeping at this point in the production, and the theatricality of it and the romance of it and the unashamed passion of these voices and this music spoke to me as a 9-year-old boy.
And possibly also as someone who worked as a fisherman at one point during your teenage years in Wales.
Yeah, my favourite job. I used to go back for the summer and work on a fishing boat, on a lobster potting boat. So the sea is something that I'm drawn to. I'm a Pisces, of course. So, yeah, always come back to the sea.
Thank you.
We heard the famous duet from The Pearl Fishers by Georges Bizet, performed by that wonderful tenor Jussi Björling with the baritone Robert Merrill and the RCA Victor Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Renato Cellini. You, Johnny Flynn, are currently on stage at the Noel Coward Theatre, starring as Richard Burton in a play called The Motive and The Cue. What's it about?
Well, Richard Burton played Hamlet in 1964, aged about 40, which is what I am now. He asked John Gielgud to direct him, and I think he thought it was going to be a walk in the park because he worked with Gielgud before, they were good friends, but it went badly. Of course, Gielgud had been associated with Hamlet all his life and been the best Hamlet of his generation in the 20s and 30s, and then that had been kind of overlooked because of the film with Laurence Olivier as Hamlet, much to Gielgud's chagrin. Gielgud, he's sad about that. He's bitter, in a way, at this point in his career, and I think he's trying to live vicariously through Burton, but Burton is not the same type of actor as him. He's much more like Olivier, actually, and Olivier is a ghost who kind of haunts the play. There's lots of ghosts, typically, for a play about Hamlet. Liz Taylor is there, brilliantly played by Tuppence Middleton. Mark Gatiss plays Gielgud. And Liz is there with all the wisdom, and she actually understands Burton and understands what he needs, and she explains to Gielgud how to access him. And eventually, it's a conversation that they have about their own real fathers and about being vulnerable with each other that breaks it down, and it's around the speech, to be or not to be. So it's about that process, and I love it because it's based on two real rehearsal diaries. One young actor who secretly brought a reel-to-reel tape recorder in and recorded all the conversations and then wrote it up in a transcript as a book. And when I ordered the book, which is hundreds of pounds because it's out of print, I found a copy for £3 online from a bookseller, and it arrived, and it was Burton's copy of the book, and it had his inscription in it.
How wonderful.
It had a dedication. He'd given it to a friend. So that felt, I don't know,
auspicious.
Auspicious, yeah.
And did you listen to things like Under Milk Wood to get the Burton accent?
I did, yeah. And growing up in, or living in South Wales helped, and falling asleep to him reading me poetry from T.S. Eliot to Dylan Thomas, watching interviews with him and Liz. He wasn't shy of giving an interview and being quite candid about everything. And I'm completely in love with him. And the diaries, of course, which are brilliant.
Is the tessitura of his voice very different from yours? Perhaps you can show us, give us an example.
Oh, you want me to do a bit?
Yes, let's just have, just to compare the two. Is it a lower, slightly lower voice?
Yeah.
To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune.
I think I'm not warmed up enough.
Well, we've come, sadly, to the final track, and it's by Robert Johnson.
Who's a mysterious figure, and I still remember hearing the Robert Johnson recordings for the first time and his high, eerie voice, kind of ghostly voice in this playing that you just can't work out how it's done. Then learning the stories about him, which are shrouded in myth. He died aged 27, I think, in 1938, after only a seven-month-long recording career. The story is that he was an average musician, and he went away for a few months, and he came back, and he was, you know, a god on the guitar. One of the original Devil at the Crossroads blues man. And he was shot, I believe, for singing a bit too romantically at somebody else's partner. So he never knew fame in his lifetime, and so he's kind of the original rock and roll star. And my son and I sit down and try and work out some of the licks at the moment. I'm teaching him guitar, and he's become obsessed with Robert Johnson, which I'm very happy about. And his lyrics are incredibly sexual and euphemistic and playful, and there's a really kind of heady, smoky atmosphere to them that is intoxicating. So he's a huge hero for me.
Well, this is Come On In My Kitchen by Robert Johnson from the album King of the Delta Blues. So only remains for me to say, Johnny Flynn, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure.
You
Come On In My Kitchen by the blues singer Robert Johnson, the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest today on Private Passions, the actor and musician Johnny Flynn. The programme was produced by Claire Walker. Next week, Michael will be talking to the writer Nina Stibbe. BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM, digital radio, BBC Sounds and on your smart speaker. Just ask for BBC Radio 3. It's 1 o'clock, time for the news, read by me, Jane Royce. The American Navy has taken action again to protect container ships in the Red Sea after a Maersk-owned vessel came under attack by Iranian-backed Houthi rebels for the second time in 24 hours. The US said it had sunk three rebel boats and shot down two ballistic missiles fired from Houthi-controlled areas of Yemen. The Foreign Secretary, Lord Cameron, he said he made it clear to Iran during a call to his counterpart there that Tehran shares responsibility for preventing Houthi attacks. The Maersk companies issued a statement saying it's pausing all sailings through the Red Sea for 48 hours. Since the Gaza war began, Houthi rebels have launched more than 100 drone and missile attacks on vessels passing through the vital shipping lane. They say the attacks are a protest against Israel's military campaign in Gaza. Russia has carried out further drone strikes on Ukraine. Kyiv said it had shot down 21 of the 49 drones launched. Moscow's targets included the regions of Kharkiv, Kherson, Mykolaiv and Zaporizhia. Russia said it was hitting military targets. Yesterday, Ukraine carried out a drone strike on Russia's border city of Bielgorod, itself a counterattack after a deadly Russian assault on Friday. The death has been announced of the Australian journalist, writer and documentary filmmaker John Pilger. He was 84. John Pilger worked for a number of publications. He was highly critical of Western foreign policy and called for Tony Blair to be prosecuted for what he described as an unprovoked war of aggression in Iraq. Eurostar services have resumed after a flooded tunnel in Kent caused all trains to be cancelled yesterday, disrupting the New Year plans of thousands of passengers. A spokesperson for the HS1 line said passengers were advised to check with Eurostar or Southeastern before travelling and apologised for the inconvenience caused at such an important time of the year. Australia has become the latest country to welcome in the new year. Large crowds have gathered in Sydney to watch a spectacular firework display over the Harbour Bridge and the Opera House. Earlier, people in New Zealand, as well as in Tonga, Samoa and Kiribati in the Pacific, celebrated the start of 2024. And here, a yellow weather warning for wind may blight the new year celebrations of people in parts of Wales, southwest and southern England, with some gusts of more than 50 miles an hour expected in exposed coastal areas. There's also a yellow alert for heavy rain in northwest England. BBC News, it's 2 minutes past one.
BBC Radio 3, the home of discovery.
Will I sing it like that? Will I tune my voice here? How far can I push the limits and how high can I go?
The home of curiosity.
I don't know if anyone's ever explained classical music to you like that before.
I think music has that way of calming the soul and focusing the soul.
The home of unique performances that you won't get anywhere else.
Well, what a completely thrilling and exuberant performance.